All yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Betty. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the second session on the fundamentals of investments. Before we get started, I want to bring some good news. We're about midway through winter, so I think that we'll get the session off to a good start that way. This is a required course. It's for your CRC study program, so I hope it's informative for you. Personally, I think it's important that we, in our position of working with retirement plans, have some understanding of the task that we're forced to face with, and that we have some understanding of the tools that we can be used to give our plan participants successful retirements. We're not experts in the field. We're not expected to be experts in this particular fundamentals of investments. We don't give advice, but we should have an understanding of the basics of the tools that we are giving our participants, and hopefully this course will provide that. The course topics that we there are 9 chapters in this session in the fundamentals of investment, and the first 4 we have covered last month: introduction to investments, risk and return, stocks and bonds. There are also cash, cash equivalents, mutual funds, annuities, GICs, stable value funds, real estate and other investments, portfolio management, and the understanding of investments. What this today's agenda will cover will be chapters 5, 6, and 7, cash and cash equivalents, mutual funds, annuities, GICs, stable values, real estate, and other investments. So before we get started, I want to touch on something I brought up last time, and it was the bad news. And that was how I mentioned that Americans got failing grades in their retirement knowledge. If you remember some of the information, it was in a survey, and it was in the USA Today, and it said Americans, where the survey was, it talked about Americans aged 60 to 75, and if you remember, there was an 80% fail rate, and the information they asked was on retirement literacy type questions. The group they surveyed were 60 to 75 year olds, and they had over $100,000 in their household assets, and they failed on knowing the basics of life expectancy, Social Security, IRAs, life insurance and investments, and really how bonds worked. There was another survey, too, that just reinforced what that first survey said. But they threw out some of the stuff we had covered in our first session, that people didn't understand certain financial concepts like interest compounding, inflation, and risk diversification. So that was the bad news that kind of set the table of why we do what we do. But the good news is, just several weeks ago, I saw an article. It was in Money CNN, and the headline was, Average 401k Balance Hits Record. So I clicked on it, and the headline expanded a little. It said, Average 401k Balance Hits Record, 91,300. That could be somewhat construed as bad news. $91,300, I think we all know, isn't terribly high for retirement. The source of this information, it was provided by Fidelity. And I think we all know Fidelity. They're a very large company, one of the larger asset managers and record keepers. So it was strictly just based on their records that they had, and it was on 401k balances. Now, they gave a lot of the credit to the stock market, and I think, as we know, in the past, there were 3 straight years of double-digit gains. That certainly helped, but what they saw was that there were larger contributions from the workers. So they had 4 years of information of the past 4 years, and 2014 was just up 2% from 2013, which isn't much. But from 2011, there was a 30% jump on the average balance. So it went from 69,100 to 91,300. So that's a significant jump. They said workers and their employers contributed an average of $9,670 in 2014. That's up 4% from the year before. So there was almost a $10,000 average contribution to the retirement plans. And they said, on average, employees socked away 8.1% of their salary, the highest savings rate recorded by Fidelity since 2011. And then if you include their employer match, workers saved around 12%. And this falls well within the 10 to 15% that's usually recommended by financial planners. So there is, what we're seeing is some impact of worker savings. Now, where they also attributed some of this increase in numbers is that a lot of it was attributed to having employers automatically enroll their workers in the plan. And I think what we've learned from sessions, certainly through NAGDA, automatic enrollment is a big feature. They were enrolled at a 5% contribution rate. Now, they also broke out a category of what they called consistent savers. And they were savers in their 401k plan who had they were in it for 10 years or more. They had an average balance of almost $250,000. And that average, that $250,000 is an increase of over 11% from the year before. So we're seeing probably the effects of compound interest also, where they now have a nice base in there, they're contributing a significant amount of money, and the stock market's helped their growth. So again, this is just on 401k. It's just a snapshot of their particular landscape. But they also did just a little blurb on the individual, the IRAs that they have. And they found that IRA holders had an average balance of $92,000 in 2014. So I think maybe the word's getting out. Certainly stock markets have helped, but that's good to hear. So that was some of the good news. So on cash and cash equivalents, that's going to be our topic we're going to cover now. We want to get some of the basic characteristics, identify some of the common type of investments, and explain some of the advantages and disadvantages. So why cash? Is there really a need for cash? Well, in some instances, there are. If you're going to use it for a short-term investment or a temporary parking space for cash, that's certainly a use of it. It's stable, it's safe. You put $50 in your savings account on Monday, come Friday, you're ready to paint the town red and you want your $50 out of the ATM machine, you're going to get $50 out. You're not going to get 40, you're not going to get 60, but you certainly get your 50. It's high liquidity. And along with high liquidity, there's generally low risk. And with low risk, we know there's a direct relationship from last month. Low risk equals low return. And we also know with low risk, low return, your purchasing power is certainly going to be affected. And it's not really, you don't want to have that over a long term. So what type of cash instruments are there? Some of the more common ones that you'll find out there are certificates of deposit. There are savings accounts that must be held for a certain period of time. Banks will typically offer this. You've seen maturities anywhere from a week to several years. And normally, just like bonds, the longer you go out on the maturity, the higher the interest rate. The shorter you go on your length of maturity, the lower the interest rate. Then you have U.S. Treasuries bills, and those are debt obligations of the federal government. Their maturities are typically a year, and because of that short term, their rates of yields are not extremely high. The good thing about the Treasury bills, they're backed by the full faith and credit of good old U.S. of A. They're often called the safest investments in existence, and I think you'll see many reports of where other foreign governments, when they're in trouble, they buy U.S. Treasuries. And the other type of cash instrument would be banker's acceptance. They're short-term debt instruments. They're issued by firms, and it's guaranteed by a commercial bank. The date of maturity on these type of products range from anywhere from 30 to 160 days from when they're issued. They're considered relatively safe. Again, they're on the corporate side of the investment. But since the bank and the borrower are liable for the amount that's due, that gives them an added type of safety feature. You have a double layer there of the bank's guarantee, and you also have the firm's certainty that they will pay. So the likelihood of both going out of business or bankrupt is certainly much less greater than should one of them fail. Then you also have commercial paper. They're unsecured short-term debt instruments issued by a corporation. Typically, they're used to finance inventories, meet some short-term liabilities, or if their accounts receivables are not immediately due, they are getting kind of a shot in the arm with some cash. Usually firms with high credit rating can do this because they're usually very quick, no banks not involved in that regard. And then you have government savings bonds. I think we all know what they are. They give the credit every 6 months, and the interest is tied to treasury notes. Then you have various types of money market mutual funds. There are three main types of mutual funds. The first one would be tax-exempt money market funds. They invest in short-term state and local securities, which we call munis, and they offer federal tax-free advantage. They're not recommended for your retirement plan because your retirement plan is already on a tax-free basis. And their yields are somewhat lower because of the tax-free position that they offer. Then you have government market funds. They're, again, they'll have the treasury bills. They're relatively safe, very safe, but they will be federally taxable, so you could have those inside of your retirement plan. And don't get confused with the term safe and guarantee. There's no guarantee from the FDIC on these type of funds, even though they are government-backed, but they certainly are safe. Then you have corporate money market funds. These funds invest in pretty much some all of the above that I have mentioned, the treasury bills, banker's acceptance, commercial paper. Their yields are a little higher because they are corporate debt-type securities, and they'll carry slightly more risk than the other, than a T-bill. So speaking of risk, is cash risk-free? You see a bunch of question marks there. For the most part, you want to say yes. There's limited, very limited business risk, financial risk, liquidity. They are in the markets. So you're bordering on risk, yes. The biggest risk that the cash will have would be the purchasing power risk. And I don't think you, if you stay in those securities for a long time, you'll find that your yields are barely keeping up with inflation. So they're, as we mentioned in one of the first slides there, they have just a use, but it's more on a short-term basis. And here are some conceptions on, or misconceptions, I should say, on money market funds. I can save you the trouble. All three are false. The government money market funds, again, there's no guarantee to those. The money market funds, they do not lock in interest rate. The yields of those funds fluctuate. The money managers will certainly try to follow the interest rates in the overall economy. When general interest rates rise, the money market fund will track it. When interest rates fall, money market fund, likewise, their yields will fall. and they are not insured by the FDIC. So now, is cash in a retirement plan? When should you put it in? There are times to put it in. One of the good ideas of doing it is when you have to do a job change. You may, depends on a company's requirements, you may need several weeks to for the paperwork or have the funds transferred to cash and then transfer it to your other company or whatever the requirements may be. If you're anticipating a rollover to another plan, you may have to convert to cash. If you have an imminent retirement, you're going to need money that's going to be your source of income. You're going to need money to pay for your expenses. So you want to convert that to cash, at least for a year or two expenses. And if you anticipate taking a loan or a hardship, you want to convert to cash. If you're having a hardship, you don't want to start timing the market and add to or double the effect of the hardship and take a chance of having a down day, and that's the day you convert and you wait to the last minute. Don't compound the hardship. A bad idea is what I just described, timing the the market. It's probably not a good idea for not only cash, but stocks and bonds. And as a safe long-term investment, it's not generally a good idea. I looked at some of the returns for, this is the past 10 years. Now, I looked at the basic stock, the S&P 500 index funds, the Lehman Brothers bond aggregate bond fund and short-term money market fund. And just over the past 10 years, just to give you a sense of why you probably don't want to be in cash for an extended period of time, the stock returned in 10 years 8.17%, the Lehman's Ag returned a little over 4.5%, and the cash money market fund returned 1.76%. So if inflation is roughly anywhere 2.5 to 3, you're just falling behind. To make it worse, I looked at just a couple more current numbers, more than 5 years. And I wasn't quite aware of this, but I guess we're taking out 2008 in that bad year. But for 5 years, stock returned the S&P returned 15.7%. The bond had 4%, and money market was 0.22% of a percent. So clearly, you're basically getting mattress returns, I guess we could say. So just remember, savings, if you've got a short-term goal, cash is appropriate. Investments, I just went through long-term results. You're probably not looking at cash. Liquidity, the general rule for liquidity is little or no loss in value. Cash will do that. And as a general rule, with cash, you have low risk, low reward. So now we have mutual funds that we want to cover, and mutual funds, we've covered three asset classes. Just now we covered cash, and last month we did the stocks and bonds. Mutual funds combine these asset classes. You can view it almost as your own personal investment portfolio. It's a collection, a nice little collection of securities. It's used in plan investments. It's used in DB plans. Not many people think so, but they are. Certainly used in defined contribution plans. And it's certainly used in personal savings. And they are so easy to invest in, and that probably is the beauty of mutual funds, the simplicity of it. So what are some of the characteristics of mutual funds? It simplifies the investment choices. I did a look at the securities that are offered on the New York Stock Exchange, the American Stock Exchange, NASDAQ over the counter. There's over 10,000 securities. I don't know if you've ever been in a grocery store and the aisle is clogged. You see some people can't decide between choosing two cans of peas. Think how it would be when you're selecting over 10,000 securities. That's the great thing about the mutual fund. It's simple. The choices are made for you. There's some decision making you have to make, and we'll get into that later. But for the most part, you're not looking at 10,000 securities. There's diversification it offers. A mutual fund could have anywhere from 100 to several hundred individual securities. The likelihood that one security will fail and become worthless won't impact the fund as much. It could be offset by a security that had just a fantastic year. So you won't have the wild swings you would of an individual securities. Across many industries, and you can go from retail to restaurants, so you just spread your risk out over a broad array of securities. You get professional money management. Those money managers, they're responsible for choosing the securities to buy and sell. They are trained, they're professional. They have a staff of analysts to support them. They have access to resources that probably you and I could only dream about. They oversee the daily operation of the fund. They communicate with the public, shareholders. They also can have access to company organizations and individuals and get their information on the funds they're investing in. It's a cost-effective way of doing business. When you think about it, if some funds are charging half a percent on $1,000, that comes out to $5. Think about what you're getting for that expertise. You're getting the expertise of the money manager. You're getting somebody on the phone. You're getting newsletters, tax reporting, the cost of just running this organization, mailing out information, maintaining the website. So they are relatively cheap when you think about it in that regard. You have a variety of investment objectives, and a variety, as I said, many securities. You can go from picking bond funds and stock funds, or a mixture of bond funds and stock funds, and you'll cross, your goals can be different. You can have bond funds for the income, and you can have capital appreciation. Another beauty of it is low minimums to invest. I've seen some with $500, but generally you can have $1,000. Some can go up to $5,000 to put in, so it makes it more accessible to the masses. And the other great thing about it is it's pulled from numerous investors. If you had two investors with just their $1,000, you're not getting much of a selection of securities, but literally these are pulled from thousands and thousands of investors. They're able to buy their securities, get better trading costs, and so forth. So when they buy their securities, at the end of the day, there is what is a popular term, you'll see the net asset value, and that's simply the current market value of the funds less the liabilities divided by the number of fund shares out there. You will see those prices are accumulated after closing, and depends on what the underlying portfolios have done. You will see either a gain, increase, a higher net asset value, or a lower net asset value at the end of the day. Now, like all investment products, there are fees, and I wanted to get a little into the DOL fee disclosure, because I think that's important. It's something we should probably strive to follow, and I think most of us do. We're all I think most of us are government plans. We're not bound by ERISA. However, we do tend to follow its rules. And back in February, the Department of Labor Employees Benefit Security Administration, they released final rules. And they wanted to help workers manage and invest their money, because when you look at these 401k type plans, you're really asking the average worker to be a professional manager. Well, they wanted to give them all the tools that they could at their access, and they wanted to make it a level playing field. And they wanted to ensure that workers in the 401k type of plans, and it's that they have access to the information they need to make informed decisions. They wanted them to have information on fees and expense, how the investment-related information is delivered. It's delivered in a format that workers find meaningful. They can compare investment options under their pension plan to other pension plans. And for plan fiduciaries, they want to use standard methodologies when calculating and disclosing this information, the expenses, the returns, so that there's just uniformity across the all plans. So they want to get an apple-to-apple type comparison and make things easier for the average worker to understand. So to help comply with that rule, if you're a plan administrator, you're to provide a participant or a beneficiary certain plan-related information, and there's two categories under that. The first one is plan-related information, and the other is investment-related information. Now, in those categories, there are subcategories. In the plan-related information, you should be giving your participant general plan information that would consist of how the structure mechanics of the plan, such as giving investment instructions under the plan, a current list of the plan's investment options, a description of any brokerage windows, or some similar type of selection of investment options that go beyond the general design of the plan. You have administrative expense information that explains any fees and expenses for just general plan administration, and it can be charged and deducted from the individual's accounts. An example of this would be fees and expenses for legal, accounting, and you certainly would have record-keeping fees. And then you have, aside from the general plan fees, you have what would be administrative, certain individual fees. And those would be fees that would be charged from an individual's account only. And as for a specific participant-based action, example of this type of fee would be if they were doing plan loans, or if you're doing something, what is common would be qualified domestic relation orders or quadros. I know in Pennsylvania's plan there is a $250 fee for processing quadros. Our thinking was that it's not appropriate to charge the whole plan for just one individual's type's needs. Then for investment-related information, this is the second category. There are five subcategories, and the first one is performance data. Participants have to be provided with specific information. You want historical investment performance. It's on a 1, 5, and a 10-year return, and it must be provided for all your investment options, such as mutual funds. And then you have benchmark information. So you have your performance of the actual fund, but you also want to have benchmark information, and that's, again, based on the 1, 5, and 10 years periods, and it has to be based on the appropriate securities. So you want to do a comparison of how your particular fund did to the benchmark. Then you also have fee and expense information, and that's to provide the total annual operating expenses. It's usually expressed as a percentage of assets. A lot of times you'll see it on the dollar amounts. They'll have a standard example of a $1,000 investment, and it will go over their fees. Here's two things I didn't know about, but they want you to provide internet website address. They want to give sufficient data. It's specific. and they want to provide participants with access to any additional information about the investment options, and you can find that on the website. And then also a glossary, investment-related information that includes a general glossary of terms used, and it's to help the participant or the beneficiary just understanding more about their options. Then you have other charges, so that covers DOL fee disclosure. Then you also have sale charges and 12b1 fees and other fees. But we're talking about fees, but cost alone shouldn't drive how your decision of which investment to go. Because at first glance, there could be hidden costs, and what may seem like an inexpensive product, that could be a case of you get what you pay for. There's two general type of categories for mutual fund costs. There are sales charges and annual expenses. A sales charge is often referred to as a load. It generally covers brokers, sales commissions, and fees that are deducted from your investment when you buy the fund. And in some cases, it's when you sell the fund. Not all funds have a load. Some funds charge just annual expenses to cover the fund's operating costs. And they would include management fees, distribution fees, 12b1 fees, and just general administrative expenses. For load funds, there's two types of load. You have a front end and a back end. And really, as the name would imply, the front end loads involve a fee right up front when you purchase the fund. And back-end loads are when you sell the fund. Front-end loads, generally they associate them with Class A shares, and Class B or back-end loads are associated with Class B shares. So a front-end load, that could make sense if you're considering a long-term investment and you have a large number of shares. And then when you purchase your Class A shares, keep in mind that the front-end load reduces the actual amount of your initial investment. So if you were to have a $1,000 investment and the front-end load is 5%, you're investing right up front $950. So just keep those things in mind. For a back-end load, again, that's on the back end of it. It also can be referred to as a contingent deferred sales load, and it's designed to really get the investor to hold on to a particular fund for an extended time. So if you wish to invest just a smaller amount of money, this may work because the sales charge is imposed when you sell the shares, and this way you'll put all your initial money up to work right away. Some of the other common fees are you have management fees. They pay for the fund's investment manager to manage the firm. They make investment decisions about which securities invest, which ones to buy, which ones to sell. You have the 12b1 fees. Now, these fees are named after the section of the law that allowed them. It's a 12b1. And they cover the fund's advertising and sales expenses. You could have reinvestment fees. They could be charged when you reinvest your distributions. You can have exchange fees. They could be imposed when you switch your assets from one fund to another. You'll have custodian fees. They're charged by the custodian, which could be the bank or the financial institution. And that's the cost for holding the funds. And overall, just general administrative fees. And they include anything from rent to shareholder services. So one other term you might see in some of the literature would be an expense ratio. So a fund's expense ratio, it's equal to the percentage of the assets managed by the fund, and it represents the fund's cost of doing the business. So they can be as high as 2 or 3%. Pay attention to the fund expense ratio. High expenses can have a big impact on your net return over time. So those are just some of the fees. And then one final note, If you are contemplating a fund with a sales load, consider that whether the return you're going to anticipate justifies that expense, especially if the load's going to reduce your money in the initial investment. So as you can see, there are quite a bit of fees out there, and you can almost see why the DOL issued fee disclosure. They wanted to make it transparent and easier for the average investor to compare all these costs. So now we have to get all of this information in one place, the best spot would be a prospectus. It's a legal document. It's issued by the firm. It discloses all their information about the fund. It has investments, their objectives, their strategies, their past performance. Covers all their fees, what risks are involved, and probably one of the more important things that gets lost in the all the shuffle is the fund management. Talking about the managers and their history and so forth. So now we have funds by organization. There are three main types. You have open-end investment companies. That's more commonly, that's pretty much the ones we're talking about, the ones we're really seem to know out there. They have unlimited shares that they issue to the public. So if the investor wants to buy shares, mutual fund company has to issue them. Investor wants to sell them, mutual fund company will buy them back. So there's no issues there. That's the one of the more common ones you'll see out there. Not so common are closed-end company funds. It's kind of the opposite of the open-end investment companies. They issue funds in a limited number of shares. So you have shares that change hands between individual investors, and they're not sold back to the company. So if I have a share, I have to look for a buyer. Then you have the unit investment trust. And these, this is unique in that they buy a set number of securities, and then they partition off those securities into units, much like a mutual fund, and then they sell them to the investors. So because there's not, it's a fixed security number, management of it is not exotic. It's what we would probably refer to as passive. There's no actively managed process in this. It's predetermined. The fund has 100 shares of Apple and 100 shares of Microsoft. End of story. They break it into units, and those shares will just continually to get traded, bought, and sold. Now we have funds by investment objective. So we covered it. There's three asset classes, main ones. You have stocks, bonds, cash. So you're going to find that mutual funds can be singular and just focus on equities or stocks, bonds, or cash, or a combination of the two, or a combination of the three. Pay attention to the objectives of these funds. They're very important. That's it's going to define your risk, your style, how you want to invest it. Some of the more popular ones, remember, you get your return from income and capital appreciation, or the value of your security. But you can have objectives that will focus on just certain categories, and I just want to talk about a couple of them. The income funds, they will pay pretty much interest or dividends. If you're paying interest, you're going to be in a bond fund. You want to focus on the dividends. You're in more equity. If you're in equities or stocks, you're probably going to invest in the common stock, or more likely preferred stock, where there's going to be some required payments of dividends. And they'll probably be in some type of securities, utilities or telecommunications, or something that will just pay a steady dividend. And you have growth funds. It's a diversified portfolio. Its main goal is capital appreciation. And in the portfolio, it's mainly of companies with above average growth in earnings, and they take those earnings and they reinvest them. They're probably more on their goal is to expand. They offer a higher potential for capital appreciation and usually above average risk because of that. They don't typically pay dividends. That's because to pay dividends, you're going to need cash, and their cash is going back into the company to again expand. Would require a high tolerance for risk, and you're probably looking at a holding period of several years. Probably an example of this would be a McDonald's in its early stages or some form of a restaurant. You open five franchises, you're plowing money, and you want to get to 10, and then you want to get to 15, and you want to get to 20. So the money and the earnings are going back into the company to grow, hence the term growth. Growth and income, combination of the two, could get debt or equity. The debt side would generate some income, and the stocks would provide an element of growth. I bring up tax-free, although they're not recommended for the retirement plans, but they certainly could have people in these in their outside holdings. It's just good to know about them. Again, they're looking for a high level of income. It's exempt from federal taxes, which would be munis. As I was doing some research, I found something which I think I knew existed, but once I read it, it hit me that the strategy of one fund was to invest a substantial portion of assets in below investment grade or junk bonds. Just the way it was worded, it struck me as, boy, you want to talk about risk. That would be one particular fund. I don't remember the returns on that one, but I found that quite interesting. Again, then you have dividend funds. They are designed really to just give you dividends, so you'll get a nice stream of income. Then you have funds by style. The stocks, generally, they're categorized. You have market capitalization and valuation. A good point is to look at the, go right down to the style box. But you look at what is popular as Morningstar's style box, it's very easy for an individual to read. They can get a good sense of the risk of the particular fund that they're in. If there's a large cap company and it's a growth, it will be highlighted in the top quadrant, and you just know what it is. And by color scheme, you can tell if it's a high risk, low risk, or some type of medium type risk. And they could do this for bonds. You can determine, have your lines of credit quality and duration or interest rate sensitivity, and it'll tell you that basically the risk elements of these, if they're high risk or low risk. And it's certainly popular with investors because it's easy. It's just you can take one look at it and get a sense of what type of fund it is. Then you have types of mutual funds, and there are just a plethora of types of mutual funds, but we want to go over some of the more popular ones. Index funds, certainly very popular, very inexpensive. Their goal is to replicate holdings and the risk performance of a certain market that they want to replicate. A popular one is the S&P 500. Their goal is to just replicate the market. They're not going to beat the market, they're just matching it. If they don't meet it, chances are there is a fee to run the index fund. So if you take your returns net of fee, chances are they're not going to beat it. And that's called passive investing. Then you have sector funds. That goes across industry lines. They tend to concentrate on a particular investment, sorry, a particular segment of the market. Their goal is to generate, again, above average returns. Certain type of sectors would be the healthcare market or utilities or energy. Certain sectors do well in certain times of the economic cycle. Then you have socially responsible funds. That's for investors who want to avoid what they call sin stocks. Things like casinos, tobacco companies, alcohol companies, or they just want to do, it's a feel-good type. They feel their money is being used for the good of social roles. You could have something such as like a Go Green type fund, solar, or that type of thing. Then you have balanced funds. Funds in this category would hold a mix of stocks and bonds. A very popular one is 60-40 balanced fund. And the 60% being the equity and 40% being the debts, bonds. So you get a little income and some growth or appreciation. What happens with these type of funds is they, of course, over time they will become unbalanced. And they typically, usually quarterly, they will go back to balance. So if one portion of the asset class is higher than the other, they will sell the higher and buy the lower. And that could be your stock tip for the day, buy low, sell high. Then you have asset allocation fund. They would be made up of all the asset classes. You have 60% stock, 30% bonds. 10% cash, very similar to the balanced. Over time, they will become out of balance and they will need to be readjusted back to their appropriate proportion. Then you have international funds. Now, these are not to be confused with global funds. Global funds will have domestic stock, stocks in the United States. Like to think of United States as in the globe, so they would be in global funds. And international funds would be the other countries. Now you got to be careful of they are higher risk. You have risks that are probably not in other ones. You're looking at currency changes, geography locations, political upheaval. So there's types of risks that aren't typically in some other type of funds. Yeah, fund of funds, and which target date funds would fit into that. They're very popular. Their goal is to have an individual at a certain retirement date out on a maturity line. You will take on more risk the younger you are. And let's say there's a 2050 fund. That would be more heavily weighted to the equity portion of the securities. Could have some bond in it. And as you approach, get older in age, the 2050 fund will change its makeup, and that's known as the glide path. You become less riskier, and you will decrease your equity holdings and increase your bonds and possibly even a touch of cash in there. Be careful that two target date funds with the same name are not necessarily the same fund. You could have two target date funds from different companies. They're 2050 funds. One may have 90% equity and 10 bond, and the other may have 85% equity and 15% bond. It's just the way they are designed. The costs could also be somewhat differently. You have funds that would have, the target date funds could be every 10 years, 2030, 2040, 2050, and some could be every 5 years, 2030, 2035, 2040. And again, their makeup would go as you come closer to your retirement age, less in equities and more in bonds. Exchange-traded funds, they're like an index funds. They are pretty inexpensive. They're becoming more popular. like a mutual fund typically is valued at the end of the day. These are baskets of securities. They trade almost real time, so that's the whether it's a beauty of it or not. One of the reasons some don't have plans don't offer these exchange traded funds, there's the temptation to do market timing, market trading, but that's really a plan's decision. And then you have emerging markets. Those are probably extremely risky. They're developing countries that are just coming into the forefront, and there's potential for some investment there. What does some of the services mutual funds provide? They have automatic investment. You can take $50 off every paycheck. You can have automatic reinvestments. You get dividends. They will buy extra shares of your securities. You don't have to worry about the cash coming in and what to do with it. There's systematic withdrawal. You can set it up that every month they will liquidate some shares and you get extra cash. And exchange conversion privileges. What that is if you have a family of funds and they have a growth and a value and a dividend fund, you may have the ability to, with no cost, to liquidate the, if you're in the growth, liquidate the growth and go into the value fund. No problem there. Mutual fund investment returns. There's two ways to create that. One, the fund does it itself, and that's within the fund, just through its dividends, capital gains. The other one, the shareholder can create it when they go in, buy and sell, and buy and sell. It's a concept of paper loss and an actual gain. At the end of the day, if you're not doing anything in your mutual fund and the NAV rises, you can probably sleep knowing you have a gain. But if you go and actually do the sell, you probably still go to sleep if you have the gain, but you just realized that particular gain. Fund research is something that you're going to have to get into, and people may ask you, well, how do I know? There's so much out there. How do I know about these funds? The best thing is, which we talked about, the perspective. Some are even the websites of the companies. If you're in a particular security, even all the websites of these companies have even their own investment section tab where they give investment information on their own securities. There's investment information firms. Some of the more popular ones would be Morningstar, which we just saw their style box, Lipper Analytics, Value Line, and there's financial magazines, newspapers, obviously the Wall Street Journal, you have financial news. There's just a wealth of information out there, and some of it's overwhelming. Selecting a mutual fund, there's no easy answer here. There's not any one way to do it. Probably one of the important things, one of the more overlooked ones, is the tenure of the manager. When you think about it, that's the driver of the automobile. If you have someone that likes to veer off the road, you're not really comfortable with that. You're going to get in an accident. So the tenure of the manager is a driver of this mutual fund. If they have a nice history, that's something you want to look for. We went through fund cost. Fund turnover, if you see a fund that just constantly is churning and just constantly buying, selling, not appropriate. You want to look for performance consistency. Funds, not every fund will be number one all the time. Not every fund will be number two. But if you can find a fund that's going to be in the top 15%, 10%, you probably have a very good fund there. And then you want to look at risk-adjusted performance and how it's used. There could be two funds that could have the same return, but that doesn't mean they got there the same way. One fund could be have a much higher risk than the other one. And the lower risk one might be more appropriate for your needs. So that covers the mutual fund. As I said, there's a lot of information on. We touched it. I know it's a lot. but it's something that has to be covered, and I think people will need to know more information about it. It's in all of our plans. Now we're going to talk about annuities, GICs, the stable values, and other investment tools. So what is an annuity? It's a legal contract. It grows so it's tax-deferred until it's withdrawn. There, key here is the word tax-deferred. As we all know, our retirement plans are already on a tax-deferred basis. Probably not appropriate for having in our retirement plans. When you talk about how they can get it immediate, an immediate annuity is when an investor begins to receive payments immediately. This is for investors that just have an immediate need. They give their money and they're getting a stream of payments. You can have a deferred annuity. That's when you typically receive payments starting at a future date, and let's hope that future date would be retirement. So with a deferred annuity, you can either invest a lump sum all at once or just do periodic payments. And again, those funds will grow tax deferred until you receive your payment. Again, the payments are made. You're giving money to a company and you're getting guaranteed payment in the future. The difference of this from, say, an IRA or other retirement plan, with an annuity, you have no limit for funding it. With IRAs, you have limits. With 403Bs, you have limits. With 457Bs, you have limits. So the ideal thing, if anyone can do this, is fund your retirement accounts first, and then you can work on the annuities. As we went with mutual funds, annuities, there's also fees involved in annuities. And there are operating expenses, account fees, and certainly sales charges, and a popular one is surrender charges. Now, surrender charges, that's a big one. When you withdraw money from an annuity with a certain period of time after you purchase it, and usually they're 6 to 8 years, sometimes they could be as long as 10, the insurance company could assess you a surrender charge, and that's a type of a sales charge. It's used to pay your professional for the commission and selling the variable annuity to you. Generally, these surrender charge is a percentage of the amount withdrawn, and it declines gradually over a period of several years, which is known as your surrender period. So say, for example, you have a 7% charge that might apply on the first year, and then after a purchase payment, and then it's 6% on the second year, 5% on the third, and so forth until the eighth year when your surrender charge goes away. Sometimes contracts will let you take a partial withdrawal and say maybe 10% of your account and just not having you pay the surrender charge. There are mortality and expense risk charges. They charge an equal, their charge is equal to a certain percentage of your account value, so usually that's in about a 1% range. It compensates the insurance company for the risk that they're taking when they assume now that they have an annuity contract. There's administrative fees. The insurer has to deduct, they'll deduct those charges to cover, again, like mutual funds, record keeping and other administrative costs. Then there's maintenance charges and other type of fees. And then if you're in any type of other product with variable annuities, the mutual fund, which we'll get into later on underneath it, you'll have those fees also. So annuity payouts. What you have here, again, as we said, they're guaranteed lifetime income. We covered all those fees. And then you have one of the payouts would be a straight annuity and a period certain annuity. So a straight annuity is when you will get it for your lifetime of the annuitant. So whether that annuitant lives 30 days or 30 years, it's going to be based on the lifetime of that individual. And once that individual deceases, payment ceases. And you could also have period certain, and that's if the annuitant period certain would be some time periods of, say, 10, 15, or 20 years. So if they die, whichever period they have selected within that period, say it's 15 years, they die in year 8, payments will continue for the next 7 years to the beneficiary. Again, the strength of the insurance company is important. You're going to be tied in with your insurance company probably longer than people have been tied into their marriages. You could be tied in for 30 years with an insurance company or more. So you want to be sure that, yes, they're in year 5, year 6, but will they be there in year 7, 8, 9, and 10, and 30? So there are certain, now what types of annuities are there? There's fixed annuities would be one. They generate there's a guaranteed fixed return, and it's for a certain period of time. They generally offer a base rate. It's expected to be paid over the year. So in this example, we use where they're going to give 6% a year. And then they offer a bonus rate to kind of an incentive to buy, so on top of the 6%, so you will get 7% for 1 year. And it depends on the performance of the fund. The next year's rate can go up or down. This will be categorized as a type of bond in that category. What are the risks of a fixed annuity? Well, generally you'll have less interest rate risk than bonds. You don't have the risk of where, as we discussed last month, bonds can go up and down in price. This, with annuity, you won't. The insurance company will absorb that risk. For someone saving for retirement, you're going to have the purchasing power risk because you are locking this over a long term. For a retiree, you have, again, purchasing power risk. Because when they take it out, it will be over an extended period of time into the future. And at that point, you're also going to have reinvestment risk. And the other one I want to emphasize, which I brought up in a previous screen, is you want to know the strength of the company, because there is also another risk, and that's the business risk. So now you have variable annuities. You had fixed, and now we have variable. Variable annuities, they're technically called deferred savings account, and they're wrapped around a mutual fund. It can offer a wide range of investment options. The value of your investment as a variable annuity owner, it's going to depend on the performance of those underlying investments. They can be investments that would be in stocks, bonds, or money market type instruments, or any combination. They differ from mutual funds, though, in several ways. For one, variable annuities, you're going to receive a periodic payment for the rest of your life, or the life of your spouse, if that's how it's set up. It's a feature, and they'll gives you protection against the possibility that after you retire, you outlive your assets. Another difference in mutual funds is you have a death benefit. If you die before the insurer started making payments to you, your beneficiary is guaranteed to receive a specified amount. Depends how it's set up. And your beneficiary will get this benefit from this feature at the time of your death, your account, unless your account is less than a guaranteed amount. And then third, your variable annuities are tax deferred. Again, not preferable for being in a retirement plan, but you will put off taxes. That means you no taxes on income or your investment gains from your annuity until you withdraw your money. You'll have to transfer transfer your money from one investment option to another within the annuity contract without paying any taxes. However, when you take your money out of a variable annuity, you're going to be taxed at the earnings of ordinary income tax rather than what could be lower capital gains taxes from a mutual fund. So in general, the benefit of the tax deferral could outweigh the cost of that variable annuity, but you probably should have to hold it in a long period of time. Variable annuities, they're designed really for long-term investments. They're not suitable for meeting short-term goals because of all the fees involved, any taxes, and any new insurance company charges. And also there's the investment risk. You do have the underlying mutual fund investment risk. Then you have equity index annuities, another type of annuity. They're somewhat new. They offer the potential for stock returns. Their performance is linked to the market performance, whichever one is you're designed to follow. A lot of times they have what is known as a participation rate. As a simple example, if your participation rate is 90%, the S&P rises 10%, your value of your annuities, you're going to get 90% of that gain or 9% of it. So that's your annuity value will rise by that. Likewise, where it could be beneficial is in a loss. If a loss is decreased, you won't get the full, absorbing the full loss. So there's one side of that benefit too. And losses are minimized because now you established what they call a new floor for the annuity value. Advanced life annuities, there are life deferred annuities. They're somewhat on the newer scale. They're single premium deferred annuities. They're also called longevity insurance. They provide a fixed income starting at an advanced age. Usually it's 85, but they don't go past 85. It's a good idea to add inflation rider because which we'll discuss later, but you're looking at this well into the future. You're probably, if you do this, you buy it at age 45 and you probably won't see the money till 85, so will there be an inflation issue? Certainly. At issue with these, you would have a conflict with the required minimum distribution rules. But there is a answer to that. And if you because I said that you can take this out up to age 85, well, required minimum distribution rules, they want you to begin payment at age 70 and a half. So because you can defer your income stream up to a later age past that, you're going to be in some conflict of required minimum distribution rules. So in order to kind of make this simpler, they have what Treasury came out with some rules recently, what they call qualified longevity annuity contracts. And there's going to be certain rules that you're going to have to meet to satisfy the what I'll call QLACs. So to be eligible for a QLAC, it's going to be one of the big rules is only 25% of any employment retirement plan can be invested in a QLAC. So there's 1/4 of your, and that's across all your pre-tax IRAs or other plans. The cumulative dollar amount invested in all QLACs across all retirement accounts cannot exceed the lesser of $125,000 or what we talked about before, the 25%. The $125,000 will be indexed for inflation in increments of $10,000, much like many of our retirement plans and IRAs. The limitations, they apply separately for each spouse, so their own retirement account, so you can have actually two QLACs, you one and your spouse the other. It has to begin its payouts by age 85 or earlier. And it has to provide a fixed payout. There's no variable or no equity index type in it. But it could have a cost of living, which is, again, a nice feature you have because it is so far out extended into the future. And it cannot have a cash surrender value once it's purchased. So in other words, it's irrevocable, it's illiquid. But it can have a return of your premium on a death benefit, and that would give a stream of income. So if it meets those requirements, it's deemed to be a QLEC, and then you're excluding the value of that when you're calculating your required minimum distributions. Now, we talked about how these are in IRAs, but they can be purchased in, if they're purchased in Roth accounts, they're not considered QLACs just for the simple reason that Roth IRAs don't have required minimum distributions to comply with in the first place. So that's one feature for to look at when you're looking at longevity contracts. Annuity rider. A rider basically are, there are provisions for an insurance company that purchases, you can purchase separately on the base policy, and it provides just additional benefits to the insurance policy. There's good thing about it is there's nursing home riders, long-term care riders, disability, unemployment, terminal insurance riders. One thing I want to point out in the riders is that the long-term care insurance with the Pension Protection Act, they created favorable tax treatment where you can add long-term care to care riders to those annuities. And the major benefit is that they're used to pay those expenses tax-free. And I'm noticing in other recent legislation that they're looking that you can tap into your retirement account to pay, use that money for tax-free and pay some of the health care coverages. So I see that almost as a trend. Living benefit riders, you have guaranteed minimum income benefits. They provide its amount where the payout will be based on either the greater of your current value or a minimum payout value. Floor is usually set at an initial investment compounded at a specific rate. You'll have guaranteed minimum accumulation benefits. That rider, it amounts to a return of your premium benefit after a specified period of time. And it's basically guaranteeing you if you put $50,000 in, you're going to get $50,000 at a minimum guaranteed. You have guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefits. They provide a fixed percentage of the original premium regardless of the current market value. It can be withdrawn for a set period of time until the full amount of premiums recovered. And lastly, you'll have guaranteed minimum withdrawals for life. And that assures that the retiree an income payment for life at a fixed percentage, regardless of how long they retire, the variable annuity owner will live. So with all those, how do you select an annuity? You got to look at the sales charges. You want to weigh the cost against the guarantee of future income. For variable annuities, you want to look at the investment performance and underlying the hood, the benchmarks. Some companies offer only certain types of the families of mutual funds. You probably are limited in that. And most of all, you want to look at the financial strength of the company. Now, again, I think this is the third time I brought this up, but I can't stress the importance of it. Just the other week, you may have seen headlines where S&P agreed to pay almost $1.5 billion to settle government charges for the crisis back in 2008, and what led up to 2008. They inflated ratings of mortgage-backed securities, and that helped set off the housing problem. So why did the government do this, or why did the S&P say they did this? Well, what I mentioned back before, you've got to be aware there's a conflict of interest when, potential conflict of interest when rating agencies do their work. And basically they're saying they had a desire to increase their revenue and the favored bank accounts. So there are three big agencies out there, rating agencies, S&P, Moody's, Fitch. They all got a share of the blame for the 2008 crisis. Where the problem came in is that they gave high ratings to securities, and pension funds in particular. I know there's investment policy guidelines that say you can only invest in, say, AAA or AA securities. Well, if these faulty securities were getting high ratings, then pension funds put their faith in that and bought the securities, they were certainly harmed. And I know there are some pension funds that are going to get some money back. So right now, S&P has done that settlement, and I imagine the other credit agencies will be hit too. The only reason I bring this up, I know you're not expected to go out and do your own crediting rating on these insurance companies, but do look at them. I think now they've been slapped. I think the ratings you're going to see will be clearly more strengthened. There are more regulations out there. Another investment product we have out there is guaranteed investment contracts. There are fixed income investments. They usually offer a set rate of return. And now there's really, even though they're called guarantee, the guarantee is on the rate of interest that's paid by the GIC, not on the principal itself. There's, because of you don't typically buy one guaranteed investment contract, you buy several, you'll get what is known as a blended rate. And as they buy, as we know, the rates will change over time. You'll see a contract for a GIC having one higher or one lower, and the rates will be blended. This will fit into the cash asset class. Other types of securities too, we have, if you have GICs, why not have a BIC? They are bank investment contracts. They're not on equal footing because of the insurance companies that do the GICs. The 2008, there are certain regulations now that of what banks can and can't do, and they're just not as popular anymore. They might be getting out of that arena. Then you have synthetic GICs that are offered by a retirement plan. The difference is with the synthetic GIC, where the insurance company owned the securities, in a synthetic GIC, the retirement plan will own the securities. There can be more diversification, and again, much as with any of the other GIC securities, there's fixed or variable rate of return offered by them. So if you want to evaluate your GICs or BICs, obviously one way to use a report card is the interest rate. If one's offering two, one's offering three, look at it. Of course, you're going to have to look and see what's under the hood. Is the one that's offering two a one-year GIC, or is the one that's offering three an eight-year GIC? You might want to look at that. Take that into consideration, even though one has a higher return. Again, the soundness of the insurance company or bank. You want to look at the fees and all the expenses and the handling of cash and what are demands on the plan. How is cash flow affecting what you can purchase? The more cash flow, the more cash you can buy, the larger GIC, you may get a better better return. Stable value funds. Now, these are very popular. From surveys, you'll see they're roughly 40% of, comprise almost 40% of plan assets in defined contribution plans. These are somewhat like GICs in a way, and I'll explain it in the context of Pennsylvania's plan. How we have it is a portfolio of bonds, which we really have designed the guidelines, and we made it extremely conservative. We wanted to stick to the theme of stable value. Our goal is to have safety of principal and have some yield to it. So you have a bond portfolio, and we have an insurance company do the wrap. And by wrap, I mean they will insure the they will provide a crediting rate And there is a formula that gives the crediting rates based on the portfolio, its duration and maturity and other numbers. And the crediting rate is set every month. So you'll have certainly a change in market value of the portfolio. So they will give a book value. Our record keeper maintains that book value. Now where the wrap will come into play is if book value, which the crediting rate is giving, is greater than the portfolio's worth, there's a difference. So let's say book value is $1 million and the portfolio is worth only $750,000. If things were to just take a drastic turn and the Armageddon would hit, the book value of $1 million has to be paid. Well, you would liquidate the portfolio assets of $750 million. The insurance company would step in with the other $250 million to make it the $250,000 to make it $1 million, make up the difference. As was described to me, and this was really from the wrapper, the insurance that the wrapper provides is basically what they called catastrophic insurance. So you're looking at the Katrinas and the earthquakes, something you don't really expect. There's built in bells and whistles that the insurance company can use to offset that they have to pay that $250 million. The crediting rate, for instance, can be set to, let's say, zero. So if you're not giving any interest on the book value side, this can be done for a two-year period. Hopefully markets will rise, and eventually market may equal book value. So that's a way to just kind of lessen the insurance company's risk there. So what we found over time is that the fees for since the crisis of 2008, the fees have gone, in our case, went up 150%, and they've gotten more restrictive on what we can offer in our portfolio, although in our case we were conservative for the most part, so there wasn't much that they did to tweak it. You have to have an equity wash where they can, they don't want to see basically a competing fund. They don't want to see a run on the market because then that affects the underlying portfolio, which could upset the crediting rate and so forth. The products that you want to offer in your plan, they would like to see so that it doesn't compete with their product and, again, force a run on the market, so to speak. And so those are just general considerations on a stable value fund. Then we have real estate. Now that's not going to find too much of that. You might find that in defined benefit plans more so. It offers income and appreciation. You have two ways where it could be in your retirement plan. That's through REITs or real estate mutual funds, which would have really real estate operating companies. You're investing in the companies that manage these type of properties. REITs are very similar to mutual funds. They have limited shares that they offer. The great thing about REITs, you're not the landlord. You're not going to get the call at 2 o'clock in the morning that the plumbing doesn't work. They do all the management. They do all the collections. They follow code of certain areas that they're out there in. Then you want to look at, if you're going to evaluate them, look at the property management track record. Also, one of the risks that doesn't generally show up in stocks, bonds, or cash is what I would call geographic risk. Where is the content of their holdings? Is it on the West Coast? Is that going through a housing recession? Is it in Vegas? Are they having a housing boom? So you want to look at that. That's one thing you want to look at. We debated whether to put the home residence in here. Technically, it is can be considered an investment. You certainly can do, you've seen reverse mortgages. We won't get into that, but that's a way to tap into some of the equity of the house. If you want to just do a home equity, there's a way to get cash and use it for other purposes. For some people, it might be the largest single asset they may own. So to really take it off the table is not fair. So you do want to give it some consideration that it is a type of investment. And then other investments that are, again, most likely not in defined contribution plans, but we just want to touch on, is tangible type investments like gold, art, antique cars, if you so happen to have that as a hobby. You don't find them typically in defined contribution plans. You're not going to get them daily valued, so I don't know how that's going to happen. But you might invest in, there might be companies that would invest in these particular products, more like, let's take the minerals. We had an individual that asked for a gold fund, and we have a brokerage window, mutual fund window, in our plan, and I thought we had some, and after research, we did not. We had several gold mining companies, but we had no gold, actual gold funds. And then what you have are options, which are derivatives, and the options are derivatives because of the word. They derive their value from other type of sources. So you can have what are types of put. That's where the owner would sell a contract, a specific number of shares or security for a specific price, and there's a set time. And then you have call options. That's basically the reverse of the put. So instead of the right to sell a security, you have the right to buy a security at a set price at a set time. An example would be if you have a share that's trading company A at $60 a share, and you happen to own a call that is $40 a share, you can call that in and buy that $60 share at $40 and net an easy $20 gain. But again, they're not as simple as that sounds. There's other issues with them. And then you certainly have commodities where you can invest in like agriculture, livestock, metals, pork bellies, soybeans, and whatnot. Again, they're not, certainly they're very high risk, not recommended for defined contribution type plans. So what did we learn today? We learned there is just a ton of investment options out there. There might even be too many, but they're out there. You have them that fit into plans, some that fit into personal investment plans. Many sources of the income for retirement. If you don't find one, you're probably not looking. But one thing we did learn, if we learned anything in the last one, it can be complex, and you have people that do not have the education, don't have the understanding, don't have the resources to get this, and that's where our plan, that's where our role comes in. So to sum it up, we looked at cash. We know cash is for a short-term need. We have bonds. We know bonds will provide you income. Common stocks, we know that's where you're going to get your growth, some income from dividends, and it'll certainly cover inflation. Mutual funds, that will take all of the three above and in some combination. Depends what your goal is. There's probably one out there. Then you have GICS, stable value. If you're looking for something stability, there you are. An annuity is real estate. If you're looking for some income, and certainly in longevity, you have those type of products. So again, just for a recap, we talked about cash, covered the last sub-asset class, mutual funds, and annuities. So I know we have some short time for questions, but I just want to mention quickly that next session will be chapters 8 and 9. That's on portfolio management and understanding of the investment environment. And that, I believe, will be March 10th, Tuesday, also at 2 o'clock.
All right. Thank you, Tony. If anyone has any questions, feel free to type them into the chat box on your participant control panel. And let's see here. All right, here comes something. Does your deferred comp plan offer options like for calls and puts?
No, it doesn't. We don't. We have a brokerage window. We have, I think at last count, it was over 5,000 mutual funds. Personally, I think that's plenty. We don't offer stocks. We don't offer bonds. We don't offer options.
No individual securities. Yeah.
Now, our thinking, yeah, too, is it's the timing the market thing. One of our board members made the comment, I'm going to paraphrase here. You're sitting at your computer and you're following the market. You're not doing your work. So you're not only doing your work, you're probably going to lose your shirt. So I,
Well, you know, and I guess, you know, here's a question for you. How many employees, what percent of your population actually uses brokerage window?
You know, we've been, from NAGDA, we've been going there for forever. And early on when people were discussing this in sessions, I heard 2%, 2%, 2%, everybody that had it.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
Lo and behold, we've had ours for about 10 years. Guess how much is in it? 2%. It's a little more, but it's amazing. It's just, we don't push it, but it's holding at 2%.
Yeah.
Amazing.
All right, here's one more for you. Regarding slide 15, their record keeper, their understanding is that Empower hasn't begun, and I think that was Great West, hasn't begun using the 404A fee disclosure for its government clients due to a formatting conflict with the deal on SEC. As a result, they maintain high fee transparency but do not issue 404A fee disclosures to participants. Is this a common situation for governmental plans, or is there a system behind the curve when it comes to providing participants with DOL disclosure?
That I'm not aware. I think it's more because of government plans. We're not required to have that. I know they like to do it. We also have Great West as a provider, and they had a form out there. Actually, it's not a form. It seems more like a booklet to me. It's quite a, it was quite an extensive bit of information. I have to follow up to see where that's at. But because of the requirement, we're so transparent in our plan. I think a lot of government plans are. Mm-hmm. Our statements have gone probably from 2 pages to about, well, it depends what, how many transactions you do, but it almost is more than doubled. There are a page and a half just every month of every fees disclosed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't say, at least in our plan, we're hiding anything.
Yeah. All right, very good. I think, let's see if we have anything else here. Nope, those are the two questions we had. So,
okay.
Well, thank you, everyone. We've run over just a few minutes here. Thank you for being here this time, and thank you, Tony, for being our instructor this time. And we will see you all on the next call and the next session next month. Have a great rest of the day. Take care.
Thank you, everyone.